We've been talking about whether protests work, but maybe a better question is when do they work and why? Mark Engler is a journalist based in Philadelphia, and he says there is a craft to protest, a series of principles that all activists can follow regardless of their cause. He outlines them in a book called This Is an Uprising, and he talked with Charles Monroe Kane.
In the United States, the idea that gets shoved down our throat again and again is that change comes from who's in office. Change comes from working within the formal mechanisms of politics. And the point that we make is that social movements function in a very different way. They function from outside of that system by putting pressure on that system. And oftentimes, they can have a transformative effect by changing this perception of what is politically possible and what is politically necessary in our society.
You know, it's interesting. I was a fairly radical anti-nuclear activist for many years in Europe. But the debate we had was three parts. Should we work through the system? Should we do some grand symbolic protests, you know, the big thing, the marches with the, you know, the dolls and all that stuff? Or should we engage in arrestable actions? Do you find through all your research that one of those three is more effective than the other? Is there a way to protest, a way to create changes more effective than the other ways?
Well, look, ultimately what we argue for in the book is an ecology of change. We argue that it really takes a lot of different approaches to creating social change to reinforce one another and contribute in different ways. You know, in the United States, you have people influenced by the labor movement or influenced by Saul Alinsky who focus on the power of building up community groups, building up institutions such as labor unions that can, you know, draw together resources and leverage the power of their members. At the same time, what we see is that sometimes these groups that are based on building up the power of institutions are sort of skeptical, or they don't have a lot to say when the moments of mass protest break out, when the Occupies or the Black Lives Matter. Sometimes they're very interested in what's going on, but it doesn't fit within that model of change. And that's why we're really interested in saying there are a different set of skills, there are some different concepts, some different tactical orientations that take place that make this a different type of organizing.
I want to ask you about a word. You use a word a lot in the book that I really liked, and that word is disruption. Do you have to have disruption for change?
Well, this goes back to something we were talking about at the very, you know, beginning of this conversation, is what are the factors that help make, you know, the movements that do succeed successful. So three that we really talk about are disruption, sacrifice, and escalation. And so the idea with disruption is that, you know, the more that you're willing to interrupt business as usual, you know, the less likely that a protest movement is to be ignored. So if you have 10 people out with picket signs on an afternoon, you know, that's pretty easy to ignore. But if you have people, you know, who are sitting in at lunch counters and demanding that they be served regardless of the color of their skin, if you have people blocking traffic or highways, going on strike, using those type of highly disruptive actions, that's much more difficult to ignore.
Okay.
So disruption draws attention to a protest. But once you get people's attention, you know, then you want to make sure that they are on your side, right? That they see the justice of your issue and that ultimately they side with you. And so people who are able to convey the seriousness of their cause, convey their sense of moral purpose and the justness of their political demands, you know, that is very important. So sacrifice someone, you know, a teacher who's willing to risk their job to speak out for, you know, education funding.
Right.
You know, that's a very powerful example.
People respect it. If you're a teenager in Montgomery and somebody puts a cigarette out on you, people see that. And you don't react violently. I respect that. Even if I don't agree with
Absolutely.
You, I respect that, right?
So, you know, the interesting thing about this disruptive movements is that these tactics themselves are very, very unpopular, right? The
right.
lunch counter sit-ins, the response to the lunch counter sit-in or to protests in Birmingham, this was what Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail was about. It wasn't written to the racists. It was written to a group of white preachers sensibly sympathetic to the cause of civil rights, saying that we're with you on the issue, but do you really have to go about it this way? And this is a perennial refrain we hear again and again and again with disruptive movements. And King very eloquently addresses the point of that. So it forces people to take sides. That's what disruption does. And sacrifice helps them take the right side.
So disruption forces people to take sides. Sacrifice forces people to pick the right side. What does escalation do?
Escalation is a very important factor because the movements that really catch on, it takes some time. You know, you have to create a sense that this is not just a one-time thing that's gone now, but instead is something that's growing, that's gaining steam. You know, the Occupy movement started with a camp, you know, in Lower Manhattan on the doorstep of Wall Street, but it was a small number of people. It got very little attention for the first week or so. It took a series of escalating marches and actions to draw people down to that camp, to make it into a movement that really seemed to be gaining steam, and that finally issued this call half seriously, not sure that anyone would respond, to occupy everywhere. So groups that are willing to do actions with a higher level of disruption, a higher level of sacrifice, actions that are not just a weekend march, but that, you know, that continue. It's a strike or a blockade or whatever it is, an occupation that continues over a period of time. Those factors can have a lot more impact in creating momentum for a movement than just turning people out.
You know, it's interesting. I think if I sat down with just 10 random people here in Madison, Wisconsin, and I asked them if protesting worked, if protesting still mattered, I think the majority of them would say no. Protesting doesn't work anymore. Do you think that's true? Does protesting still work? Does it still matter?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely it does. I mean, again and again, the major changes in our society, whether this is women gaining the right to vote, whether this is civil rights, whether this is ending child labor and creating labor protections, these have come about not because of that inside political game, but oftentimes through the social movements that put these issues on the map. You know, I agree with you, and I think it's sort of sad, Charles, that the default position in our society is this sort of cynicism. Mm-hmm. You know, it is, what does this do? What does protest accomplish? And that's why it really takes work like this to remind people not only what protests accomplished in the past, but what it continues to accomplish and to really affect our sense of political possibility.
Mark Engler is the co-author of This Is an Uprising: How Nonviolent Revolt is Shaping the 21st Century. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him.